You're listening to the FQXI podcast.
Today, physicist Ian Durham begins his countdown of the top five physics stories of 2013.
They even have a way set up, you could even literally put it in your pocket and walk around with it, and it wouldn't really decay all that much. So that is incredible. It's such a monumental jump.
And astronomer Sarah Seeger tells us about aliens, exoplanets, and being awarded a MacArthur Genius Grant.
People have wondered for thousands of years, are we alone? And this is really the first time in human history that we're on the verge of being able to answer that question.
She's Zia Murali.
And he's Brendan Foster. Welcome to the new edition of the podcast from the Foundational Questions Institute. Before going any further, we should, of course, congratulate the winner of the 2013 essay contest, who is...
Matthew Leifer. Matt's essay was called It From Bit and the Quantum Probability Rule. It gave a really thoughtful presentation of some very difficult ideas. The contest theme was It From Bit, or Bit From It. And Matthew's essay was... Oh, no. I lost my link. Okay, one more time. Matt does a great job of combining challenging ideas in a way that makes you think, but at the same time, also not inaccessible to a...
But also, not inaccessible. That's a double negative there. So accessible, in fact.
Yeah, but also in a way that's accessible to a non-professional audience. Many of our top winners in the contests over the years have been experienced writers, and Matt as well has an excellent blog. So go to our website, fqxi.org/community/essay. You'll find Matt's essay as well as links to all of our other winners who all discussed a very difficult question, it from bit or bit from it.
Yeah, so thank you again to everyone who entered, voted, or just, you know, discussed the essays on the website. And Brendan's just given you the link there, so please do continue to go and read them and discuss them, because I know the entrants appreciate all the feedback.
And now back to the podcast. Now, our regular listeners, hello, Uncle Jim! We'll have noticed that that was an unusually short menu of items at the top of the show.
Yes, we barely had time to listen to or savour the FQXI jingle, written, I should say, by Brendan Foster and friends.
And still perhaps available somewhere out there on the internet. Not that I'm trying to plug my old band, I really want to plug my new band, Mink Hollow.
Oh, Brendan, I'm going to have to stop you there because we seem to be digressing from the physics. So let me just pull it back and reassure our faithful listeners. So, hi again, Brendan's Uncle Jim, and also hello to my mum and dad too.
And my cat, Puffy.
Oh, and of course, hello to Brendan's cat, Puffy, who's not just an avid listener, but also sometimes takes part in the podcasts. I want to reassure you all that we do have an abundance of physics-y goodness for the month of December for you to overindulge in during the holiday season. So much, in fact, that we have decided to put out not just one.
Not one.
Not two.
Not two.
But three.
You're kidding.
Nope. Honestly, three editions of the podcast this month.
Surely not. That may actually be too much physics.
Well, it's the holidays. And people can always make a New Year's resolution to cut down on physics in January to make up for it. Now, to start with, we have the sequel to physicist and FQXI member Ian Durham's hugely popular rundown of the top physics stories of 2012, which we're imaginatively calling...
Ian Durham Strikes Back.
Well, I was going to go with Ian Durham's countdown of the top physics stories of 2013, but Ian Durham Strikes Back is a lot better, although it doesn't make him sound a lot scarier than he is.
Ian, I am your father.
I really don't think this is a time or place to be making such personal revelations, Brendan. Now back to the physics. You may remember that last year, there was some controversy, as Ian went against pretty much every other physics list and did not choose the discovery of the Higgs boson as his number one news item.
I was quite surprised. Are there more surprises in store this year?
Oh, yes. In fact, before we even get to the fifth item on the top five, Ian began by listing a few of the physics stories that made the headlines this year, but didn't quite make the grade. Hello, Ian Durham, and thank you again for joining us for another Year in Physics Roundup.
Thank you for having me. This is a lot of fun.
And of course, you were with us in 2012 when we did a very similar roundup. And at that time, we did hope to meet again for this year's roundup, but we were also a little bit worried that we might all be killed in a kind of Mayan apocalypse that was predicted for 2012.
Indeed, and we nearly were, because there was a giant meteor that blew up over Chelyabinsk, Russia. It was a close call, but we're still here.
We're still here, so that's the first thing to say, I guess. We're just happy to be here. I don't know if there's anything else you want to say about that meteor, because it was very, very dramatic. I guess it got a lot of people talking about, you know, how to track asteroids and whether we are all going to die at some point. So,
well, we are all going to die at some point.
That's a good point. Yeah, that's an accurate prediction there.
And I'm glad that nobody got seriously injured. But it was good because it got a lot of people talking about science. Certainly, it highlighted some of the threats that are out there, because nobody had picked up on this meteor, just this giant hunk of rock floating around, and even though we monitor such things, and it should have been, in theory, large enough to detect, nobody picked up on it. It made quite a spectacular explosion, and knocked out windows and garage doors, and online videos were quite impressive, and luckily, it just happened to end up in a lake. But it does, it highlights some of the more dangerous aspects of living in the universe that we live in.
Right, so actually the Russian meteor doesn't make your list of top five results of the year.
No, it doesn't.
There are a couple of other things that people might have thought could make your list, but you know, you've been very discerning this year and very strict, and you've thrown out a couple of big results, so... Do you want to tell us a little bit about some of the kind of also-rans who haven't made the top five?
Sure. My criteria for doing the top five was I wanted it to be a breakthrough on the part of humanity in some sense. And I wanted it to be a positive breakthrough scientifically. So the Chelyabinsk meteor, we had nothing to do with that, so it didn't make my top five. The fact that we exceeded 400 parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere also didn't make my list, because it's not a positive outcome. It certainly is a human thing, but it's not a positive outcome. But some of the more foundationally physics things that did not make my list, a lot of you may have heard of the amplituhedron.
Oh, yes, yeah.
Is a new multidimensional way of doing physics that is supposed to be better than some of the old ways, specifically particle physics. One of the things that particle physicists do a lot of is to calculate scattering cross sections and things of that nature, and this is supposed to basically make it a little easier. At the moment, you have to compute these things called Feynman diagrams, and you have to compute a lot of them.
And just to clarify, so the amplituhedron, which has a really horrible, unfortunate name, but I guess it's some kind of, you know, it's been touted as kind of the jewel at the heart of quantum physics, and it's some kind of weird, I guess, multi-dimensional object that allows you to do some of these quantum calculations that you've been talking about by kind of mapping it to the volume of certain points in this object or something like that. It's kind of a geometrical way of simplifying specific calculations.
Correct. It's a geometric structure that basically simplifies how you calculate particle interactions. We like to think of geometry as being very visual, and indeed there is a visual element to this, but geometry can extend, just like all of mathematics, it can extend to many more dimensions than the human mind is capable of wrapping its head around. And that's kind of what the amplituhedron does. It extends some of this stuff to higher dimensions, and so it's not quite geometry in the same sense that, you know, a high schooler would think of geometry. And this is supposed to make things easier. However, there's a little caveat to this. The amplituhedron doesn't actually work in the real world yet. Hence, it didn't make my list. It offers some promising possibilities, but it's not mature enough. I'm a big believer, as much as I'm also a mathematician, I'm a big believer that physics has to be physical and real. Otherwise, it's just philosophy. So I think that one's got a little ways to go.
Right, okay. And then, you know, another one that's sort of very headline-grabbing, and I have to admit I wrote an article about this one, and so I know that it really grabbed people's attention, was this idea that experiments have shown that you can reach negative absolute temperatures, which I think just puzzled everybody because the definition of absolute temperature is that you can't go below zero. So can you explain a little bit about, I mean, what that even means and why it's not worthy of being on your list?
So there are a couple of reasons it's not worthy of being on my list. I think there's a misunderstanding. People have a tendency to think a certain way about temperature. In particular, most average people use either the Fahrenheit scale or the Celsius scale to do temperature. Scientists actually use the Kelvin scale, which doesn't have an arbitrary zero point. So why is 0 degrees Celsius where it is? Well, it's the freezing melting point of water, which is, I suppose, not really arbitrary, but it's still rather arbitrary. I mean, you could, why not do the freezing melting point of metal, you know? The Kelvin scale is designed so that it's absolute. Absolute zero on the Kelvin scale is usually thought to be, well, they're sort of defined to be, a complete lack of energy. So objects that have energy in the universe have some temperature, and the only way to have zero temperature would be to have absolutely no energy whatsoever. However, temperature isn't really defined by the scale that it's measured on. Temperature is actually, it's defined based on an average of the energy. There are actually several ways to define it. You can define it in terms of the concept of entropy as well, and actually the relationship between entropy and energy. But basically, if you think about it this way, if you think about a bunch of gas molecules floating around in a room, and you were to take all these gas molecules and you were to say, all right, what's their average energy or average speed as they're moving around in a box or something like that? If there were no absolute zero, if absolute zero didn't exist, then you'd probably get something like a nice little bell curve. But because absolute zero exists, there's a sharp cutoff at one end. And that's how we define temperature. And by definition, then, a positive temperature is anything that falls on this energy scale. The way we have the temperature defined is it relies on this absolute bottom, you know, zero energy kind of thing. So what these guys did is they said, well, they kind of flipped the tables and said, well, what if there was an absolute maximum kind of thing, an absolute maximum kind of energy, and it flipped the entire plot around? Well, in that case, the signs of everything would just flip, and you'd have, by definition, a negative temperature. A bunch of gas molecules with a negative temperature would, by definition, have a negative pressure, which means they'd collapse in on themselves. But the thing is it's not really clear that there is an absolute, I mean, certainly there's nothing physically that says there has to be an absolute maximum universally. This is just in a very particular system that they defined this. So it's a bit of playing fast and loose with the language. I think it's a really great result, and it offers some fascinating possibilities for the future of materials and physics and things, but it's not as profound as everyone thinks it is.
Okay, well, fair enough. And
You may have to edit that.
No, I like that. That was a good explanation, having banged my head against the desk trying to write a story about it myself. That was pretty good. I wish I'd spoken to you at the time. But actually, also, I guess earlier this month, there was a paper that came out in Nature Physics that kind of called into question, you know, all these claims about being able to create negative temperatures, and talks about sort of the definitions of entropy and the way that we kind of have to think about what's going on in these situations. So for those that are very excited about this story, I'll put a link to that paper on the website too, so you can go away and, I guess, look at more reasons why Ian's right not to put it onto his top five list.
Well, and again, I think you hit the nail on the head. In science, everything is, well, particularly in physics, you have to start somewhere, and one of the places you start is by defining your terms. And so we had to define temperature in a sensible way so that we could use it and repeatedly use it. And the way it is currently defined, a negative temperature simply means, on an absolute scale, simply means that they've kind of flipped the graph around and that they're assuming that there's a hard and fast cutoff at the top end. It does not mean that these objects have a negative energy. And that's the important thing to remember. These objects absolutely don't. In fact, they have a very, very high energy.
Okay, and then one more before we actually get onto the list proper. And this one might really shock people because, well, I guess if they're fans of Physics World, which probably many of our listeners actually are, they might notice that this story that hasn't made your list was the number one on the list chosen by Physics World. So what is it, Ian, and why isn't it on your list?
So this is the Ice Cube Cosmic Neutrino Experiment. Basically, we've been detecting neutrinos since the late 60s, early 70s, and neutrinos have been theoretically around for a long time, but all the neutrinos we've ever detected have come, as far as we know, from the sun or from nuclear reactions on Earth. Cosmic neutrinos, so neutrinos that come from distant stars or the remnants of supernova explosions or whatever, have been harder to detect because of their energies. So neutrinos are notoriously difficult to detect because they only interact in one way. They interact via the weak nuclear interaction. There is no other way that they interact with anything. Meaning of the four fundamental interactions of nature, you know, gravity, electromagnetism, strong and weak interactions. Weak is the only way they do it. And so it's very, very, very hard to detect them. And they're virtually massless. And the higher energy ones are even harder to detect. They just pass right through stuff all the time. So they had this thing called the Ice Cube Experiment down in Antarctica, where they buried a neutrino detector deep under the ice. And they were able to first observe neutrinos that they definitively were able to say were cosmic neutrinos. And while this is a really great advance, I think this is important. And it does, as they mentioned, it does herald a new era, I suppose, of neutrino astronomy, because right now, astronomy is entirely based on electromagnetic radiation, with maybe minor exceptions for astronomers who work on the solar wind and stuff like that. If you're looking at anything that's out of the solar system, or even most things in the solar system, you're observing through electromagnetic radiation, light, either whether it's visible light or X-rays or gamma rays or radio waves or microwaves, something like that. This would provide a different way to detect things, and it does have the advantage that neutrinos, because they go through all sorts of things, we could actually detect things that might not actually have been detected electromagnetically, because electromagnetic radiation can be absorbed by gas clouds and things like that, whereas neutrinos can't. So don't get me wrong, this is a really great discovery, and I think it came very, very close to my list. But the reason it didn't make the top five were, one, they talked about it ushering in an age of neutrino astrophysics. I would say that's a bit of a stretch because it's an enormous, enormous project. And to really develop neutrino astrophysics, somebody's got to find a way to detect cosmic neutrinos that isn't so amazingly expensive and massive of an undertaking and localized. Right now, we can only observe things using this observatory down at the South Pole, because that's where it is. So I think there's more that has to be done before this really makes a huge difference. While it's amazing that we got cosmic neutrinos, I think it's just not quite mature enough yet to say, wow, this is the big one. It's not, basically, I had five others that I thought were just a little bit better.
So thank you to Ian Durham, a physicist at St. Anselm College in New Hampshire, for telling us what didn't get onto his top five. Wow, so Physics World's top story of the year, the detection of cosmic neutrinos, didn't impress Ian much. He's like the Shania Twain of physics list-making. Shania Twain crossed with Darth Vader.
Well, there's a sentence I never expected to hear. We'll find out what does make Ian's list later in the podcast. But before that, in 2013, FQXI member Sarah Seeger at MIT was awarded a MacArthur Fellowship.
A MacArthur Genius Grant. Even Ian would have to admire that.
Now, Seeger was also one of the very first recipients of an FQXI large grant, way back in 2006, to fund her research into the characterization and search for life on hot, rocky exoplanets. So we asked reporter Colin Stewart to catch up with Seeger and ask her how the hunt for extraterrestrials is coming along.
Sarah Seeger is Professor of Planetary Science and Physics at MIT and one of astronomy's most renowned planet hunters. She also recently received a prestigious MacArthur Genius Grant. I started by congratulating her on the award and asked her what it means to her personally.
Well, it'll make a difference in two or three different ways. One of the ways is the MacArthur Fellowship. It ends up giving me a platform to have a voice. What I mean by that is that although I'm already well-known in my field and well-respected, the MacArthur Fellow just gives a kind of stamp or blessing from the outside. And fortunately or unfortunately, some people actually need that in order to feel like they should call upon you to do various things. So in that sense, I think the MacArthur is really going to open up doors for me. In another sense, it's been less good, and that is given me a bit of notoriety in situations that I wasn't known before, like my neighborhood, my children's school. And in those cases, I honestly, I'd rather just be anonymous.
The grant totals $650,000. How are you going to spend the money?
It turns out they let you use the money however you want in order for you to support yourself to be creative. And I have decided to spend all of my money on the home front. And the reason I'm doing that is because right now, if I have to do things at home, like laundry, cooking, dishes, a lot of endless household chores, my brain is filled with thinking about what I have to do next rather than I could be just sitting around after dinner or relaxing or sleeping and thinking about a problem I'm working on. Like the other night, I woke up in the middle of the night and I just figured out this complicated geometry problem. And that's a lot better, trust me, than thinking about food management. So actually, most people use it for work, but for me as a single mother with two children at home, it's just a blessing for me. I want my mind to continue to be able to just wander to something very interesting I've been thinking about and not wander to, oops, I forgot to get milk from the store, because that's what ends up happening.
In the past, you've also received a grant from FQXI. What did you spend that money on?
I am so thrilled to tell you about what I ended up using the FQXI money for, because at the time when I wrote the grant, I knew there was a big new field in biosignature gases. This is actually an established field. It's a field about how we're going to find signs of life on planets that are kind of like Earth that are orbiting stars other than the sun. People are very focused on Earth's biosignature gases. On Earth, we have oxygen. It's produced by plants and photosynthetic life in huge abundance, such that our atmosphere has 20% oxygen by volume when it should have none. But the question is, out there, when we are able to find Earth-like planets and look at their atmospheres for gases that don't belong that could be biosignature gases, we really need to cast a wide net. What are the chances we're going to have one just like Earth with oxygen? I don't know what the chances are, but I know we're not going to have thousands of planets to study. It's going to be more like 10 or tens of planets. So at the time, I proposed to FQXI to start something kind of new and to do some thermodynamics-based biosignature gas research. And I used the money for 6 months of a postdoc. He worked on microbial science, taking microbes from the deep sea and trying to understand what they did and how their metabolism worked and what kind of gases they used and output.
And what's happened with that work?
So I'm really happy to tell you about that because the fruition of that initial investment finally came. And it's in the form of a couple of papers that I just got accepted in the Astrophysical Journal literally a month ago.
Can you tell us a bit more about that?
We call it a biomass model estimate. You can actually use thermodynamics to give a biomass estimate. That is, how much mass do you need to be producing a certain flux? We said, let's look at exoplanet biosignature gases a different way. Let us ask ourselves, how much of a certain gas do we need to detect in the atmosphere? And then we say, well, how much biomass would we need to produce that gas flux? And is that biomass physically plausible? So with this framework, we're now able to expand beyond oxygen and think of other gases, and we'll be able to tell you, look, this is not a plausible biosignature gas because on this particular planet with this kind of atmosphere and this kind of star, we'll need 100 kilometers thick biomass around the whole planet. And we don't think that's physically possible. So actually that grew out of my original FQXI grant, this biomass-based model of how to move beyond terracentric biosignature gases.
And what did the second paper cover?
That paper asked the question, well, could we have biosignature gases in a planet different from Earth, a planet with a hydrogen-rich atmosphere? You know, Earth does not have hydrogen and helium in the atmosphere because it's a light gas, and Earth can't hold onto it. Those gases escape to space. But we believe that there are not only planets that do maintain hydrogen, but there are certain exoplanet observations for which a puffy hydrogen atmosphere is very favorable for observation. So we're motivated to understand whether or not biosignature gases could exist. And we were able to show, as a kind of proof of concept way, that if biosignature gases are produced, they could certainly accumulate in a hydrogen-rich atmosphere. And for some of those gases, it only requires a sort of very plausible amount of biomass.
So really, you want to move away from an obsession with oxygen?
Right. Exactly. And it's not that I don't believe oxygen's a great biosignature gas. I do. I just have a concern that we don't expect nature to repeat itself identically everywhere. And that, at least in my lifetime, I'm not going to have an infinite number of planets to look at. It will be just a handful. And so I want to make sure that we know what we're looking for.
How do you know this abundance of gas is caused by life and not some other natural process like geology?
Yes, well, that is such a great question. The bottom line is that life has the same chemicals to work with as geophysics does. So we see over and over again the same basic molecules that are used by life. They're also used by geophysics. Reactions are happening all around the Earth. So typically we end up with a lot of false positives, and that's why we revert to the concept that you need so much of a gas that it just, you can't argue that it can be produced any way other than life. So you could safely say that oxygen is 9 or 10 orders of magnitude above what it should be. So we're looking for gases that don't belong, and so we'd have to see a gas that just makes no sense whatsoever, or that's in so much abundance in proportion to the other gases in the atmosphere.
Biosignature detection is some years away, so what are you working on that we can do now?
One of the things I love about FQXI is the organization supports foundational questions for which answers might not be obtainable until the future. Observing biosignature gases in exoplanet atmospheres is quite a long way off, so a lot of my research focuses more on what we now are excited to call mainstream exoplanet science. And in particular, there's a few objects of interest that we have good spectra or good atmosphere data. And one of those is Kepler-7b. And my students and postdocs here at MIT, in particular, Bree Stemmery, Nicole Lewis, Julian DeWitt, did a lot of work on trying to understand Kepler-7b using Kepler data and data from the Spitzer Space Telescope. And what the team found is that it's kind of crazy, but it really appears like Kepler-7b has clouds on it and they're unevenly distributed. So it's pretty exciting that we can actually make observations that exoplanets have clouds in their atmosphere.
Why is exoplanet research important? Why have you dedicated your career to hunting out alien worlds?
People have wondered for thousands of years, are we alone? And this is really the first time in human history that we're on the verge of being able to answer that question. We'd like to know, did life originate and flourish elsewhere beyond Earth, or did it not? We're the first group of people that gets to actually look at planets and try to see if there are signs of life elsewhere. People are doing this also for solar system planets, Mars, possibly Europa and Titan and other places. But the exoplanets just offer a huge quantity to look at. And it's a great question in a way, because if we see something that looks like it has signs of life, we'll be so thrilled, because when there's one, there's more. But if we see nothing and no signs at all, it'll take the next generations much more effort to try to answer the question, because their reach will have to be much greater to involve many, many more planets.
So what have we learned so far about how common or unique we are?
Before, people thought our solar system would be everywhere, that we would see copies of our solar system with the giant planets far from the star and small planets closer to the star. And it turns out that we have not yet found any solar system copies, and we think they may even be somewhat rare in our galaxy. This is pretty shocking when you think about it. To me, one of the most surprising and significant findings in exoplanet science is that the most common kind of planet around sun-like stars in our galaxy is actually not Jupiter-sized planets. It's small planets, about 2 to 3 times the size of Earth, for which we have no solar system counterpart. And we don't even really know how those planets form. It may be that smaller planets are even more common. We don't know that yet. But all the techniques are pointing towards saying that the most common type of planet is not a Jupiter. It's a much smaller planet.
Finally, you started your career in cosmology. When you switched over to exoplanets, could you ever have imagined how big it would get?
No, I never would have envisioned that the field exploded in this way. Looking back, I worked in cosmology only briefly as a master's level student. And when exoplanets were discovered, I switched to work on exoplanets for my PhD thesis. But it's so interesting, because I think what ended up happening was the best and brightest and the risk takers and the most enthusiastic people jumped on the field and were willing to just work in obscurity or face the challenges and the biases that other people put forward and just keep working. And as soon as we found that nature was so generous to us, nature gave us planets all over the place, easy to find planets, big planets, hot planets. Every technique could find planets. And then more and more people just kept flooding into the field, and then it just snowballed. And that's why the field has exploded, because people are so interested in the topic, and because nature made planets literally everywhere.
That was Sarah Seeger chatting with Colin Stewart. We have linked to more info about Seeger's original FQXI grant on the podcast page, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast. Now, if she just finds some aliens, I'm sure that would get onto Ian Durham's countdown of the biggest physics news items of the year. Maybe. So, are we now ready to hear what came in at number 5 on his list?
I think we are. Here we go. The 5th best physics advance of the year is a record breaker.
Okay, so coming in at number 5 is an interesting story that came out of Simon Fraser University in Canada, and I guess with some assistance from some people in the UK and Germany. They managed to get a quantum state that lasted at room temperature for 39 minutes. Now, this is pretty impressive. So most quantum states don't really last that long because the quantum world is constantly in flux. There's always stuff going on. And in particular, quantum states, quantum things, are very susceptible to their environment. They're the touchiest things out there. If you have a piece of electronic equipment or your car and you think it's finicky, it does not even come close to as finicky as quantum states are. They don't tend to stay in one particular state for very long. In fact, the previous record up until this year was 2 seconds.
Okay.
And these guys got it to last for 39 minutes at room temperature. And at 4 Kelvin or so, I believe they actually got it to last for 3 hours. They even have a way set up, you could even literally put it in your pocket and walk around with it, and it wouldn't really decay all that much. So that is incredible. It's such a monumental jump from 2 seconds to 39 minutes. And what's impressive about this is that isolating quantum states, if you can get quantum states to stay the way they are for a long enough period of time, you can use them for things like quantum computers. So, for instance, quantum computers are based on the idea of being able to take a quantum state and manipulating. And in fact, these guys, what they did was they were isolating the nuclear spin of phosphorus. And by taking that and flipping the spin up or down, you can essentially get a qubit. And the problem with, you know, existing methods is that the qubits don't last very long in their state, so it's very hard to calculate much. You can calculate a few things, but it gets hard. But when you have a quantum state that lasts for 39 minutes, you can make some serious calculations in that time. That's a long time.
I've got a statistic here that I've pulled up, which says that they could perform more than 200 million operations in 39 minutes. So that is quite impressive, even though 39 minutes might not sound that long, I guess, when you just kind of say it like that. I mean, you wouldn't want your actual computer to stop working after 39 minutes or something, your laptop breaking down.
Yes, and it wouldn't be necessarily that the computer stopped working after 39 minutes. It would mean that you'd lose the coherence and the state itself would not be what it was, which means it would be like having a bit inside your computer only hold its value for 39 minutes, which you could imagine would be a bit of a problem because it would be like you would be starting your computer from scratch, meaning like the day you bought it, every 39 minutes.
I had a Windows Vista laptop that actually did work like that. I had to kind of
well, there you go.
Reinstall Windows every day.
Mac, right? So the thing is you could extract the information that you get out of the quantum computer and put it somewhere else once the 39 minutes is up, and then the computer will still work. You just have to reset the quantum state.
Do we know how they managed to do that? Because it's such a dramatic jump. It seems like they must have used some kind of new type of technique or some new trick. It's not just a case of kind of making small refinements to an existing technique. Or was
it? Yeah, what they did was they took phosphorus atoms that were in silicon. The other cool thing about this is that they did this in a semiconductor. So this is the kind of thing that has a lot of promise for the future of semiconductors. So you get silicon. Anytime you have a crystalline structure, you always have impurities in it, and you can also do what's called doping. You can add atoms to the lattice structure. So when you have phosphorus atoms that are in a silicon lattice structure, when they're at room temperature, they have a tendency to give up their electrons, and they become positively charged ions. They don't give them all up, but they give up some, so they become positively charged ions. When you remove those electrons, it eliminates a link between the nuclear spins and the surrounding electrical noise. So the spin of the nucleus is affected by all of the electrical noise from the electrons around it. But when you pull those electrons off, it's almost like a bare nucleus. It's not quite, but it's almost like that. And it doesn't get affected by the electrical noise that most atoms have. Now, of course, the problem is that when you remove these electrons, the nuclei become so well isolated that they can't be read or written to, meaning you've got this great qubit, but then as soon as, of course, being quantum mechanics, as soon as you do something with it, you change its state, right? So it's like, oh, darn. So to get around that problem, they first cool the crystal to a really, really low temperature, 4.2 Kelvin, and then they used some laser and radio pulses to put the atoms in a specific state. And this is, by the way, a very common way of doing this. Other groups have taken ions and used lasers to put them in specific states before. And that, so this is nothing new there. But then they could ionize the atoms before the crystal was warmed up to room temperatures. And so then once they sort of got it up to room temperature, it's almost like they could freeze it in the way it was set up. What this is really important for is the ability to store information in a quantum state. And bringing it up to room temperature, that's what allows it to kind of hold its state for 39 minutes. And then to get the information back out again, you've got to cool it back down and manipulate it. But in any case, I think that's just amazing because that's a huge leap forward in our ability as human beings to control things at the ultra-microscopic level. And that's just impressive. It's not something we've ever been able to do before. 2 seconds to 39 minutes is amazing.
Okay, thank you to Ian for picking out a very worthy, record-breaking quantum achievement there to take fifth place. There's a link to the paper and a news story from the Oxford Quantum website about their experimental feat on the podcast page, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast. So, what's at number four?
I'm afraid, Brendan, for that you'll have to tune in to the next podcast.
Oh no, a cliffhanger.
Yes, sorry about that. So, stay tuned. In the meantime, thank you to Sarah Seeger and Colin Stewart.
And of course to Darth Durham.
Ian Durham. He's been Brendan Foster.
And she's been Zia Morali. What do you think sounds better, Shania Vader or Darth Twain?